Hi, I'm Lauren.
And I'm Charlotte. Our pronouns are she, her. This is The Myth Turns the Page,
the podcast where we fly through the sky.
I didn't check how to pronounce this. We track Yakshas.
And speak to Kritika H. Roa about her debut novel, The Surviving Sky. Did I say that correctly?
You did, yes. Thank you for having me over.
Hi, Kritika. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here.
Before we get into your book, please could you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Sure. So my name is Kritika H. Rao. I am the author of The Surviving Sky. It is an epic science fantasy, which is kind of based on Hindu philosophy. And it's a story about this husband-wife duo who are in their 30s, which is kind of new for, or at least not as much done in science fiction and fantasy. This couple in their 30s who are trying to save their marriage as they're trying to save their floating plant city from crashing into jungle storms. So it's got some romance in it. It's definitely got some mystery and just like a really cool world, which I certainly love living in.
That's why I think I found them more relatable as a couple than most fantasy couples, like being in my 30s. It's like I can't understand why they're having these arguments. What kind of books do you like to read?
Wow. Well, my first love is very much science fiction and fantasy. And in that, it is very much fantasy. But I kind of grew up reading a lot of science fiction, you know, the regular Dune kind of stuff, but also Michael Crichton, actually, who is very rarely credited as a science fiction author. If you kind of look at the genre labels, he's often credited as a mainstream thriller author. But then, you know, you see some of his work, Jurassic Park and, you know, Prey and all of those, like they are clearly science fiction. So when I was a kid, like I was very much into dinosaurs and yeah, I kind of started reading science fiction from there, but also fantasy, really, like all of your big fantasies that you kind of see, you know, N.K. Jemisin is a favorite author. Andrea Stewart is another one. Melissa Caruso, Fonda Lee, like there's just so much good work being done in fantasy these days. So it's a really exciting time to be in the genre.
If you like Jurassic Park, I have to ask, because a lot of people don't agree with me on this. Jeff Goldblum in those leather trousers, like, did he do things for you when you saw that film?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, I mean, who didn't he do things for?
I know quite a few people.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. Yeah. Those trousers, Jeff himself, like, of course. Just came up and lit the screen up, didn't he?
Well, I know we're going to get on already then.
Where did your inspiration for The Surviving Sky come from?
It's interesting because when I was kind of writing The Surviving Sky, like some things were kind of foundational to me writing it. Like I knew this was going to be based off of Hindu philosophy, and a lot of my work inevitably tends to be, you know, in that realm. But one of the things that I really, really kind of started with was the fact that it is going to be a story about this husband and wife, primarily because like you never often see a married couple in science fiction and fantasy. You often have these like coming of age stories, you know, younglings, you know, for lack of a better word, really just people in their 1920s most often become the protagonists, and then, you know, they go off and have their adventures. And if at all you have like an older character in 30s, 40s or whatever, they tend to be a mentor character who come and do their business and then maybe die, right? But it's just such an underexplored space, really, for a married couple in their 30s. And one of the ways that I wanted to show their relationship grow and mature, and the fact that just because they're married doesn't necessarily mean it's happily ever after. And I wanted to put them in a fantastical place, like the world of the Rageous trilogy, where they affect the world as much as the world affects them. So really, that's where a lot of my ideas started to come from. It was very much the idea about this husband and wife who are in very opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to the power and privilege that they have in their world and how they deal with that, especially when it comes to their marriage and their relationship. Like these are two people who love each other, but the world has put them in very different places in life.
Before we get into the actual story, please can we talk about your cover? Because your cover is so pretty.
Oh, but gosh, it's stunning.
Is that an earth rage happening sort of at the bottom? If we take the cover from like top to bottom or bottom to top, is that an earth rage happening?
It is, yeah. So just bottom to top, it is an earth rage happening, and you can kind of see the jungle, and you can see like lightning and these jungle storms. And if you look closely, you can see just the plants and vegetation just kind of breaking apart. And the artist is Leo Nichols, and he is just so brilliant. Like, honestly, I have literally taken I zoomed into the cover, and when I've had the book, like I took a magnifying glass to it, and the sheer detail in the cover is just like mind-blowing. It is amazing. Like, you can take pieces of it and look at it, and they just kind of pop out every now and then when you're not really anticipating that you're going to see them. So yeah, that is an earth rage. And then you can see the floating city as well on the cover, and it's kind of shaped like a diamond, and the bottom half is just a tangle of roots, and it's a plant city. And then the top half is just like wooden architecture and engineering and bridges that are carved in buildings and houses. And again, like if you kind of zoom in or look really closely, you can see beyond the architecture, just vines and things just hanging out and shadows and mysteries. And it's such a glorious cover. I think I really lucked out there, because I know a lot of authors, you know, don't often get the cover of their dreams, but I did.
It looks like a photograph.
Yeah, it does. It's so stunning.
Most authors that we've spoken to have all been really happy with their cover. So I'm waiting for one person to turn around and be like, actually, I hate it.
I'm really happy to hear that most people are happy with their covers. That's awesome.
I can't wait for my physical copy to come, because obviously we're talking to you before the book has come out, and we've been reading it on Kindle, so I can actually have my physical copy. So yeah. I get to look really closely at all of the details, because it's just so pretty.
It's stunning. Yeah. It's just a floating city up in the sky, and the sheer number of colors that you see in the sky, the transition of, you know, it all kind of looks hopeful almost at first glance, but then you look deeper and you're like, oh, there's some darkness lurking in this world. And the cover just shows that so beautifully.
Are there going to be different covers for different territories, maybe US or?
No. So this cover being just so gorgeous, and, you know, Titan, who are my publishers, they're publishing in the US and UK Commonwealth. And so we're going with the same cover everywhere. It just feels like such an iconic cover too for this. So,
and I think it's, you know, it's very indicative of what is in the book as well, which some covers, you pick up the book, and I know you're not meant to judge the book by the cover, but let's face it, everybody
does.
Yeah,
we does.
Do. Yeah, everybody we does. Do. That's the point of a book cover.
Yeah.
And you pick it up and you go, hang on, that is not what I was expecting.
For sure. Yeah, that's such a good point, because for one thing, you know, to your earlier point about judging books by covers, like we all do it. And I think in a way we kind of have to, because that is the first point of marketing that the book really has, right? Like you kind of walk into a bookstore and you see a cover, and it has to inform so much about the plot and the world and the mood and the themes and the genre. And this, it, like, a cover does heavy lifting. And in my case, for The Surviving Sky, it's just stunning, like how it speaks to the plot, because the world building, the plot, again, very much, it's like, it's a very detailed world. Like I've heard across reviews and readers and blurbers that this is a book that, you know, they can get lost in. And I wrote it at the height of pandemic. So I was actually looking to lose myself in a different world, because, you know, our world left a lot to be desired. So I was like, well, I'll just make one. The cover kind of really speaks to how expansive the world is, but also how detailed and how personal, I think. And the more you kind of peel back layers, there's just so much more to find out. And for me, that is my favorite part of the cover. Is when I wrote The Surviving Sky, I very much wrote it as a kind of book which I hope, at least, that if people read it a second time, they will see more things. Like they will view the characters maybe slightly differently. They will see parts of the world and the plot that they hadn't seen before. So it's very much written for a reread as well. And I find that the cover really does that too. It's, you know, you kind of look at it first glance, but then you look at it again and again and again, and it just, like, this beautiful imagery just pops through. So yeah, I'm just so grateful to the artists and my team.
Do you think it kind of goes cover, title, blurb, and then maybe the author's name, depending on if they're an auto by author or you've heard them recommended? But yeah, cover, title, blurb.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think you've got it spot on. Yeah, for sure. It's I know. So, and to add to that list, it would be cover, title, blurb, and then you kind of open up the first page and maybe read like the first few lines, or, you know, again, to get a sense of what the mood of the book is, perhaps, or the voice, you know, the elusive voice that, you know, authors are chasing all the time, what that kind of sounds like. I know I've picked up books because of that. The premise as well is a big one. So yeah, the blurb.
One thing that we really liked was how queer normative your world is. You also bring up topics such as adoption and abortion. And Lauren and I are quite new to the sci-fi genre. But do you think, in your opinion, this is something that's missing from the genre?
I think it was historically, but I have to say that right now, there's just so much wonderful work being done, you know, in the genre that there's a lot of people, you know, tackling these big subjects right now. And I'm really grateful to be able to do that myself. So in my case, like I know you've had Sunny Dean, for example, on the podcast, and like she's spoken about motherhood and her book is very much about motherhood and things like that too. And again, these are some things which haven't historically been talked about. And her book is also a queer book. I don't know if she would necessarily call it that, but it's definitely sapphic in its seams. So Tasha Suri is another wonderful author who does so much good work, Shelley Parker Chan, and, you know, just so many wonderful authors who are doing great work for queer people. For me, it was kind of a no-brainer to have The Surviving Sky in the World of Rages trilogy be queer normative. I'm queer myself, and it was just a very easy decision. It wasn't even a decision that really needed to be taken. It, you know, it is what it is, and the world was queer, and I didn't want it to be a world where being queer was seen as being different. It was just very much a part of the world and accepted and normal and as it should be, right?
Do you think by having main characters that are a bit older, it allows more for topics like adoption and abortion, kind of with the way that you've written the world, they're more around these kind of things?
And that was going to be my question.
Divorce as well, actually. Divorce is mentioned.
Divorce too,
in the book. And they're sort of topics that we don't think of people in their 19, like that are 19 and 20 is sort of...
Yeah, I mean, I will say that was a hope that, you know, we won't hear people in their 19s, 20s thinking about it. But given what's happening in the US with laws, et cetera, it's really become everyone's problems right now. But to your point, like, yeah, I think the themes of Surviving Sky are very much adult because the protagonists are adult, right? So things like abortion, things like adoption, the fact that this is a married couple, we talk about divorce, they have issues in their marriage despite loving each other. I feel like my generation, and this might just be, you know, some kind of a bias because, you know, at least in my friend group and author circle, et cetera, these are definitely issues that we think about and we grapple with when we're kind of considering our place in society. I mean, this is a generation of millennials, like, you know, I've said this before elsewhere, like we grew up with all kinds of hope, at least to a certain extent, about what our world might end up being. And then we saw war after war, we saw rights being stripped away. And not to say that other generations have not seen this, but I just feel like the onslaught of trauma that our generation kind of endured on a global level was, at least I think in many ways it was unprecedented, right? Like here we are parents, a lot of us who are still to some degree dealing with the effects of the pandemic, which, you know, I mean, I'm one of the people who believes that COVID has not really gone anywhere. You know, we've just kind of shut our eyes to it. So we're still dealing with a lot of that. So all of those themes, including abortion and divorce and, of course, marriage and adoption and all of that, children and childcare, all of that have definitely found a place in this book by virtue of the fact that in so many ways, this is a reality for my generation. And these are questions that we've grappled with over the last many years. And I at least the reception to that I've kind of gotten is also like it's been overwhelmingly positive because for a long time there, these questions weren't really being addressed in fiction that we are reading. You know, again, it was escapist to a point like, oh, these problems or these situations don't exist at all. But I wanted to be escapist to a point of like, here's a different world, but there are some issues that you might relate with, right?
High above a jungle planet float the last refuges of humanity. Plant-made civilizations held together by tradition, technology, and arcane science. In these living cities, architects are revered above anyone else. If not for their ability to physically manipulate the architecture, the cities would plunge into the devastating earth-rage storms below. Charismatic, powerful, mystical Iravan is one such architect. In his city, his word is nearly law. His abilities are his identity, but to Ahilia, his wife, they are a way for survival to be reliant on the privileged few. Like most others, she cannot manipulate the plants, and she desperately seeks change. Their marriage is already thorny. Then Iravan is accused of pushing his abilities to forbidden limits. He needs Ahilia to help clear his name. She needs him to tip the balance of rule in their society. As their paths become increasingly intertwined, deadly truths emerge, challenging everything each of them believes. And as the Earth rages become longer and their floating city begins to plummet, Irovan and Ahilliad's discoveries might destroy their marriage, their culture, and their entire civilization.
This is the bit that I'm really, really fascinated about. So can you talk to us a little bit about the Hindu philosophy that you've woven through the book? Because it's something that is so, so new to me. And it's, after seeing the cover and the name and the concept, which was quite cool anyway, the idea that you've woven Hindu philosophy through a science fantasy book, just, I knew I had to read it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for saying that. So the Hindu philosophy parts of it, and I did want to be clear about this just for listeners and readers in general, like the book of the Surviving Sky book is very much about Hindu philosophy, but it's not Hindu mythology. So if you kind of enter into this world expecting like gods and goddesses and, you know, all of that, like I think you'll be disappointed because there's none of that, you know, like gods and goddesses are never actually mentioned. But what I was more interested in was the philosophical part of it. So there are some things in this world which are a given, things like birth and rebirth, which is one of the cornerstones of Hindu philosophy. In Hindu philosophy, you don't, like, yes, you do have a heaven and hell, but again, these are such insignificant almost concepts, because the purpose of life, according to Hindu philosophy, is not to aspire to either heaven or hell. It is to live a good life so you can then be reborn into a better life. And in frankly, even that is like an oversimplification. The point of Hindu philosophy, especially when it comes to birth and rebirth, is to break the cycle of birth and rebirth altogether and achieve total nirvana, right? From the cosmic cycle of constantly being born and dying and all of that. So all of those concepts are very much embedded into the world of the Surviving Sky. The magic system is consciousness-based. So one of the characters, Iravan, he's one of the main characters. He can perform this magic where he essentially is able to connect to the consciousness of plants and then, you know, manipulate them into doing things such as building the world of the Rages trilogy, building architecture. Him and other architects like himself manipulate plant consciousness to build architecture which sustains them in the sky. So even that perspective of consciousness being something that is fluid and mutable, I think is a cornerstone of Hindu philosophy, which made its way into the book. The fact that you can connect to consciousnesses, that, you know, they are individual and discrete, but they're also part of a greater narrative. Those are pieces of Hindu philosophy that kind of came in. So there's just so many parts of it. And if somebody is familiar with Hinduism and with Hindu philosophy and Hindu mythology, I think if they were to pick up the book and read it, it would be a very different experience for them as opposed to somebody who does not necessarily know about this. But I designed the book very much to be accessible to anyone. So whether you know about Hindu philosophy or are learning or are not really sure versus, you know, you just want to pick up a good book and kind of escape into it, I think you'll find that there's room for all of those experiences within the book. And that was something, as a fantasy lover, especially as a secondary world fantasy lover, I think that was very much what I was kind of going for. It is based on Hindu philosophy. Yes, that was intentional. Was that necessarily the whole point of the book? It wasn't. Like, I was trying to write a good book that I found entertaining and fun with philosophies that are meaningful to me, which kind of made its way in there and will hopefully reflect back to readers who I represent.
For people who haven't read the book yet, can mm-hmm. you introduce the people to a little bit of why we are where we are, like living with flying cities, earth rages?
Yeah. So, the story is kind of based in a planet which is just besieged by these cataclysmic storms called the jungle, called the Earth Rages. So it's essentially a jungle planet, and which is constantly attacked by these surface storms called Earth Rages. So the only way for civilization to exist was to take to the skies. Now, because this is a jungle planet, magic kind of evolved in such a way that plants could be manipulated, and those humans or magic practitioners, I mean, I never use the word magic, but that is essentially what it is in the book. So those people are called architects because they create architecture for people to live in. So plant life is manipulated into architecture for like buildings and houses and all of that. And the city itself is plant-based and it floats above jungle storms. Every now and then, there is a lull in the jungle storms and the earth rages, and then the cities land briefly. But again, it's a very brief landing just to recharge before they take back to the skies. So it is very much a story of survival because they can't actually land on the very planet that they're in.
And the architects that you mentioned, can you explain to our listeners who, again, who haven't read the book, mm-hmm. where exactly architects are in the kind of power structure of these cities? And our female main character, Ahilya?
Yes, Ahilya.
Ahilya, she isn't an architect, but her husband is.
Yes. So the two main characters are Ahilya and Iravan. They're married to each other. And Iravan is one of the senior architects of his flying city. And architects are at the top, the very top of the power chain. Like, they are the most revered because survival obviously depends on them. They have like rules and structures as well. Like, they work really hard to keep the city afloat. And there's obviously costs to, you know, all of the work that they're doing, but they are still very much at the top of the food chain. All of their lore, their history, everything is very much around architects and revering them and how they essentially saved humanity by taking humans to the skies. And so Iravan, being a senior architect, is literally at the very top. So you have different like tiers of architects, and he, being the senior architect, is actually a counselor of his own city. So he is like, if in as much as there can be anyone who is like all powerful, his role encompasses that. He's of course not the only one. It is a council of senior architects and other people who kind of dictate how a city moves and, you know, when it lands and what grows and all of those fun things. But he's very much at the top. And on the other hand, you have Ahilya, his wife, who doesn't do magic. She is just a regular citizen. She is married to, you know, this man who is so powerful, and she herself has no power at all. And this kind of rubs her the wrong way often, because as it rightfully should, because like, architects are provided all kinds of privilege in that world, which people like her have like none of. They have rights that other people don't have. They can go into places that, you know, other people can't go. They get to make decisions about their living situation that people like Ahilya cannot. Everything Ahilya does, from her job to her, you know, in many ways, her entire existence is kind of at the mercy of architects. It's never quite as desperate as, you know, as I'm kind of making it sound, but that's only because architects can appear to be very benevolent. So a lot of times it's not necessarily done maliciously, but that is just the status of the world, that is just how it's kind of evolved. So Ahilya is trying to change that. And she's trying to explore, as an archaeologist, in direct contrast with Iravan, how survival can change to an extent that it's not dependent on a few privileged people. And this puts her in direct conflict with Iravan himself, because essentially in many ways she's challenging his power. A lot of their conflict ends up being kind of sourced from that big difference between their own personal situations and powers within the world. And it's just an interesting question for me, especially when you love someone that much. Yeah,
I have a lot of opinions about that, but we'll get into that later. certainly with some of those kind of themes throughout the book, you can tell that you wrote it during COVID.
Yeah, for sure.
Talking about the powers, presumably it's not something that you can develop. Is it something that you're either born with or you're not?
Yeah, so architects are always born with that. So they're not made. You can't train and just become an architect, which is another reason why, you know, this rubs Ahilya and many people like her. Well, actually not many people, it's just her and her friend. Like, everybody else is kind of bought into that, you know, thinking. She's one of the rare few who is like, no, this is wrong, we need to change this. Like, nobody's recognizing how wrong this is. So yeah, architects are born with the power, and in many ways, like, if you are born with the power, you are an architect. You have to be an architect. Like, there's nothing else that you can do with your life either.
This isn't a spoiler, because we find this out pretty early on, but their marriage is not in a good state. Yeah. Ahilya seems really either resentful or angry at the architects, and she says quite early on that control is being taken away from normal citizens. Trying to take a really neutral position here, do you think it's very easy for her to make these kinds of assumptions when she doesn't have all of the facts? Or do you think that the power in this world is set up in a way that's quite secretive?
I think it's a bit of both and then some. I think it is easy for her to, well, I won't say easy because it's not like she kind of comes blindly to these, you know, these decisions, etc. She's thought a lot about this and she's experienced a lot, but there's certainly a huge element of secrecy in the world and power, etc., which eventually as we read the book, we kind of realize exactly what is happening. So yeah, there's a little bit of that. It, you know, she is one of the few people in the world who sees that something is wrong. You know, why are all of us so okay with the fact that, you know, these few people in our world have all this power and are dictating everything about survival and our own lives? Like, why is that okay? So she's one of the few people who even dares to ask that question. She dares to ask, like, why is it that our histories are all architect histories? Like, what about people like me? Like, where is my history? Why is my history only in relation to, you know, the people in power? Like, why am I such a side note? Like, what happened like back in the day, right? Like she's one of the few people who actually dares to question that. So it's how she's wired, but it's also not necessarily an easy thing because she's obviously struggled with it. She's married to this man who is an architect, who is a senior architect, and she loves him, and she's kind of seen how he, you know, he used to be and now suddenly is as a man in power, what he's become. So she's definitely struggles with that, but she also doesn't have all of the information. I think to a point that you made, like I was in the book, you have chapters both from Ahilya and Iravan's perspective. Like they are both of them equal main characters. So it's not necessarily only Ahilya's story or not necessarily Iravan's story. It's both of their stories and both of their perspectives. And when I was writing it, I was very, very like deeply embedded behind either of their eyes. Like I was like, you know, when I was writing Ahilya, I'm like, god damn, she is right, she is awesome, like, you know, how the hell can Iravan do this? And then when I was writing Iravan, I was like, oh my god, like he has a point too, and you know, I totally get his perspective, and he's just a poor cinnamon roll, and you know, he's not, but that's what I was thinking. So for me, it's really hard to kind of delineate between the two, because sometimes I'm like, they're both wrong, and sometimes I'm like, well, they're both right, and they just have different pieces of the puzzle, and I think together they kind of eventually their mission is to discover what they can do with those pieces.
There's a line quite a bit later on, and this might not be the line word for word, but it's that the histories of people that are not architects had failed to endure because of their inherent irrelevance to survival, which I thought was a really cool line anyway. And so I kind of understand why she is frustrated that it's only architect history. But when you're in a situation where things are so desperate that you basically need to fly or you'll be destroyed, I kind of get why it's their history and their way. Although I do sympathize with what she's saying, but also I'd rather survive and be in the sky and maybe not have as much power than be destroyed by earth rages.
Yeah, and I think that's such an I loved writing that line, and this entire storyline for me was just so interesting, because I think even in the future books you kind of end up seeing this question of survival being explored a lot more. And one thing I found while writing the books is that survival is not as easy as dead or alive. And you know, at least in the books, like these, there are concerns that they kind of think about is who's survival, you know, how much survival, what are ideas that are surviving, you know, is there space for other ideas as well. I belong to a marginalized, many, many marginalized communities. I will say I'm a queer woman of color living in North America. So, you know, that's an interesting life. But I belong to these communities, and, you know, we've kind of in many ways seen our own history replaced, you know, mutilated, changed, morphed, erased, really, which is that erasure of history is a big thing that Ahilya grapples with. I've seen that happen to communities that I belong to. And there's always, you know, at the end of the day, like you often hear this from people who are apologists for that erasure, to say, well, that was the only way for progress, or, you know, sometimes they use survival, but often it's like progress or things like that. And that always begs the question, like, who's progress, right? Like, who's survival? Like, you know, you can get so caught up in just one community and one identity's way of living and survival that everything else just becomes collateral damage. And in this world as well, it does. it, you know, were there no other ways of survival? Was there only one way, which was to fly to the skies, and or were there other ways? I think these are questions that Ahilya herself is looking for answers, really. And that is what determines her, you know, pursuit as an archaeologist, is to look for survival in a different manner, which does not involve architects. So historically, she's like, well, this is the line that we've been fed. But as an archaeologist, like, it is her job to question that history and say, is this true? And if it is, like, you know, were there other pieces to it that are missing? And if it's not true, then what is being hidden? So she's very much, you know, she's a very astute archaeologist, and she asks all the right questions.
I don't think this is a spoiler either, because this happens within the first 50 pages. But she is desperate to go on an expedition when Naqsha, is that how you pronounce it? Naqsha, okay. So when Naqsha, their flying city, lands, and she has permission to go and track something called a Yaksha. And this seems like, to me, like it's a kind of giant animal that somehow survives earth rages, but we don't really know much about them. And she believes that by understanding how these creatures have survived, then human society might be able to actually relocate to Earth and not have to rely on the architects and these flying plant cities. But she has other intentions than just going and tracking the Yaksha. And you know, she grated on me a little bit when it's like, you've not even been honest with your own husband about this. And I totally get why she wasn't. But on the other hand, I think she's very quick to judge him when we go into the book within the first 50 pages knowing that she's hiding things.
I have to say, I'm really enjoying this interview, because I get the sense that you love Iravan, you know, and why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? I love him too. God, I love him to pieces. But it's so funny because, like, I actually have review readers right now on, and I don't know when this recording is going to air, but I hear from reviewers and from booksellers and just, you know, friends and fans kind of reading the book right now, how much they hate Iravan and how much they love Ahilya. And it's so funny to me because, like, when I was writing the book, and, you know, I had a bunch of different beta readers, and they got into a fight amongst themselves because one of them was so pro Iravan and one of them was so pro Ahilya, and they were just like, oh my God, like, why are you not seeing this from his perspective and why are you not seeing it from her perspective? And I'm just like sitting there, you know, just like smiling away to myself, because I'm like, yes, mission accomplished, because it's true. Both the characters can be so frustrating, and you do see things from their perspective, and you want them to badly work things out, but it is because you see things from their perspective that you realize that it's not as easy as, like, oh, let's just have a conversation and we'll figure it out. Like, you know, adult communication problems usually end up, you know, being a bit like that. You can't just have one conversation and figure it out. There's so much, like, history that you share with each other. But going back to your question about how, you know, there are secrets that Ahilya also has, and obviously there are secrets that Iravan has as well. I think that's very pivotal to the story and who they are, but also to the world and the power structures they kind of have around them. Iravan cannot tell Ahilya everything because that's the nature of his job. Ahilya cannot tell Iravan everything because that's the nature of his job. You know, the things that she in her world is allowed to do and not allowed to do, dictated by, you know, the mandates of architects like Iravan, there are so many rules and things that she has to obey, which she does not see as anything beyond the fact that they're trying to control her. Grates on her. And so she's a kind of independent spirit who is like, this needs to get done, and I'm going to be really careful about doing it. You have given me no other choice except to use subterfuge. And while I don't like doing it like this, like, if this is all I have left, then I will do it for my community and, you know, for the things that I'm pursuing. It's really interesting because Ahilya and Iravan are so different, but when it comes to their rationalizations, they can be so similar. Like, they will take risks and they will take, you know, they will do stupid shit. I don't know if am I allowed to say that?
Yes.
But they will, yes. Okay. But they will do stupid shit like that, and then rationalize it for, in their own minds, for the greater good and that kind of thing. Do they have reasons? Yes. Are those reasons good? Potentially, yes. Does that make the risk okay? I don't know. You know, like, each of them would kind of disagree and say, I don't think that risk is okay. But each of them would also end up doing that themselves. And they're very flawed characters. I mean, there are no heroes here in this book, I will say, but there are people who are trying their best. And I think personally that is the most that we can do in the world. as adults. Like, we live in a complicated world. There are no easy answers. There are, you know, nuances and nuances and nuances. So much so that you can lose yourself completely and forget what is right and what is wrong. And ultimately, that's one of the questions that both Ahilya and Aravan struggle with, is like, what is right, you know, in this situation? What is the right thing to do?
I think it makes a more interesting dynamic if they are both slightly flawed. And, you know, you mentioned about, oh, it's not one conversation and then everything sorted, because then I guess there'd be no book if everything got sorted in one conversation.
Yeah. And I find, like, it's not, you know, the trope of, like, miscommunication is very irritating to me as well, I will say. But you never really see that with Ahilya and Aravan, I don't think. You don't see them misunderstanding each other. You see them misinterpreting each other often. You see them not understanding each other's intentions, perhaps. You know, it's never like, oh, we didn't just talk, although, you know, there is a little bit of that, because they're so mad at each other that sometimes they just don't want to talk. And I've been there. You know, I'm like, I need to cool down because I cannot have a civil conversation with you right now. I've had that experience. And if in my anger I say something, I'm like, wow, this was a lot of venting and all of that, but I don't think I actually said anything of value here that's going to help our relationship, right? Like, so I've been in those situations, and as have these characters. And I find, like, with adult communication and adult, you know, at least in this case, in Ahilya and Aravan's case, you know, they love each other so much. They're so close to each other. There's things like ego and, you know, forgiveness and intention and reading someone for what they used to be and what you had hoped out of them and for who they are right now. And, you know, the writing on the wall, there's just so many different aspects to really understanding communication with each other, that it's not so much about the facts that are being laid down, it's about what is being left unsaid. How is that being said? You know, what is the tone behind it? Are you, you know, do you mean what you're saying? Are, you know, is this real? Are you being honest? Like, I think those are questions as opposed to, like, here's a fact, we are talking about it, the end. You know, it's not as simple as that. I don't find it as simple as that. So their a lot of their conversations, many of them which turn out into fights or, you know, or arguments, etc., really have this layering. Like, neither of them is actively lying to each other, but are they telling the truth? I think those are two different things.
I do really like Aravan, though. Like, I can't pretend, like, fuck feminism, right? I like Aravan. But
I like him, yeah. Too. He's hot as fuck. Like, totally. Yeah.
Talking about adult conversations as well, and this is how petty I was as an adult. I was with one of my exes and they would be like, okay, I don't want to, this, we're not going to fight anymore. This conversation's over. It's like, I'm not ready to stop fighting. So I would talk to one of our cats who was there and be like, oh my God, can you believe what just happened and how out of order they've been to me, with them listening. And then that rekindled the fight, and I was like, yes, I got what I wanted, because I wasn't ready to stop fighting. So I think, you know, as adults we are possibly even more petty than teenagers. I'm proud of it.
I get it. Like, I totally get it. I think there was a lot of that kind of dynamic that I was also trying to pull into the story. It's, and especially, I think, and you know, you mentioned that with your ex, and I think that's also the nature of a marriage in this situation. Like, when you're married to someone, you want them to know you. You want them to understand you. It's not just so much about the words that you're exchanging or the information, but you want them to understand your moods. You want them to know where you're coming from, that, you know, foundation of trust that you base this marriage on. And in the book, Ahilya and Aravan have been married for 11 years, and I'll have to go look at my notes, but I think they courted for at least like 4 or 5 years before that or some such thing. So they've been together for a really long time. They know each other in and out. Like, they know each other's, like, aggressions. They know each other's tricks. They know each other's, like, you know, way of keeping secrets. They know how each other, you know, they talk, and, like, what this tilt of head means and what that, you know, intake of breath means. And they are so close to each other, and they know each other in and out. And it's because they know each other so well as they know themselves, why they get so mad at each other. And, you know, they're like, why are you not seeing this the way that I'm seeing? Like, you know, this couple so closely is to be almost, you know, again, almost to be in so many ways a very similar person while being very different people. That's how close they are, which actually lends really well into the philosophy and the world building of the book, where consciousnesses are connected. right? Like Iravan and Ahilya are very, very much connected, but that doesn't mean they're not their own people.
We've already discussed how incredible and stunning your cover is, but at the end of each chapter, you also have pictures, little pictures of beads. Do they represent Iravan's beads?
Yes, they do. So those beads are called Rudra beads. They are essentially a combination of the magic, which is called trajection, and the engineering in the world, which is called sungineering. So it's based, it was initially based out of, you know, the pursuit of finding solar energy. That's why they called it sungineering. That's not how the technology evolved, as you'll learn in the book. But that's really where that image comes from. And those beads are a status symbol as well. They're not just jewelry for a status symbol. And I think that's something true in the world of the surviving sky. So very lush, you know, green, rich, vibrant, layered world, but also beauty is very much balanced along with survival. So even this form, which is those beads, which you'll see Iravan wears, those are status symbols. Each of those beads carries permissions for the city. You know, you can tap into those permissions, you can change architecture, you can go into places you're not allowed to, go out of the city if you need to, that kind of thing. And usually it's only very, very high level of counselors, et cetera, who have those beads. So the greater your prestige and status, and of course the permissions that you hold, the more beads you end up having. And Iravan, as being one of the top people in his city, has many beads, which he wears around his neck and his arms and all of that. Ahilya, being, you know, one of the people who has very little or no power, only has one bead, which is part of her citizen ring. It's just a ring that she has, which keeps her connected to any kind of communication, etc., in the city. So yeah, I was really happy that that graphic kind of made its way to the end of the book. It's also really interesting because those beads signify an evolution of society, in a manner of speaking. And as you kind of read book 2 and 3, you'll see that image slightly change in terms of what it means, including in at the end of the chapter, and of course in the book as well, just how the magic and engineering and Ahilya's own status, etc., how that kind of evolves, which actually I should show you. I don't know if you saw this on my Instagram, but this is a cover art thing for Iravan.
Oh.
I know my camera is not that great, but if you kind of go into my profile on Instagram, you'll see that that's Iravan and that's Ahilya with all her.
Oh, beautiful.
She looks really beautiful.
Yeah, she's lovely. And yeah, so if you're interested, like, please go check it out. And you can't really see it on this, but you know, if you kind of look at the picture on Instagram, and again, that's my camera and the lighting in here, you can see the trajection tattoos on Iravan in this picture, and it's so awesome. Yeah.
This is the point of the episode where if you haven't read the book, you should stop listening. Go read the book and come back when you've finished, because the architects are going to construct spoilers, including major plot points and the ending. I'm not sure if this is spoilers, but we're going to ask it now at this side, just for safety. We don't want to upset anyone. Earlier on in the book, we get a flashback between Iravan and Ahilya when they were talking about having a child. She accuses him of only wanting one because of ambition and not because he actually wants a family with her. She also rightly or wrongly believes that architects look down on non-architects. And there's a moment where Iravan engineers for himself to go on her mission. He talks a lot about the architects and, you know, architect problems, hashtag architect problems. But then there's a moment of realization that normal citizens can't actually relate to this and have nothing to relate to. Does he need this moment of realization going forward to try and improve his relationship with Ahilya? Because it's pretty much rock bottom now.
It is, yeah. And I think he does need that moment. I think one of the things, and again, this is so funny because I was talking to another bookseller about this, and they're reading The Surviving Sky right now and really enjoying it. And they're like, I have hope for Iravan. And I was like, well, hope for Iravan should be the tagline for the entire series in many ways. We all have hope for Iravan. Yeah, we really love him, but also he infuriates us, and, you know, as does Ahilya, honestly. But yeah, I think So there's a few pieces of it, right? Like when Ahilya says to Eravan, she's like, architects look down upon us. She's not wrong. There is so much evidence that she has about architects looking down on non-architects. And for me, this really came from a place of experiencing microaggressions myself. I think that's very much in the world of Surviving Sky. You never have like very overt tones of, you know, bullying or any of that. But you have so many these insidious little, you know, instances of microaggressions and expressions and just ways to demean a whole section of society without coming out and saying, you know, you suck. You know, so I think there's a lot of that kind of stuff that Ahilya picks up on, and she sees it, and she knows that other people do as well, and she calls it out, and she says, like, you always, people like you look down upon us. And she's not wrong, because whether or not he admits to it, like, or whether or not he has rationalizations for it, Eravan ends up doing that too. And when we are in Eravan's head, we actually see why. Like, he's not doing it out of a place of maliciousness. Like, he's not doing it because he thinks they're lesser. He just does not think that they're going to get that level of magic or whatever, which in some ways can be interpreted as, you know, like, well, thanks for being so condescending, bro. You know? So yeah, I think that was a moment for him when he actually, after a really long time, he kind of came to terms of the fact that, wow, this, have I actually bought into this way of thinking? And now when I'm seeing my wife do these amazing things, like, I, you know, I am surprised. Like, I think he gets really shocked by how different, he gets confronted with the fact that he has become different. And that's one of the first few times in the book that we see that he is actively confronting that fact instead of brushing things under the rug and saying like, oh, I'm just doing this because of XYZ reason. So
he actually acknowledges that he feels like an outsider as well. Yeah. And doesn't really like it.
Yeah, because he feels like an outsider in his own marriage. And I think that's a beautiful thing about Eravan, right? He's so, he really redeems himself with every second or third. Like, you know, he'll have like five thoughts of like, you know, bullshit, which make us really angry with it and be like, come on, man. And then he'll have like the fifth thought or the sixth thought, which completely change everything and redeem us, redeem him in our minds. And we're like, oh, okay, like, you're not a bad dude. You're a good dude. And he just repeats the cycle ad infinitum. And it's so annoying because you're like, oh my God, you were so close. Like, just make that leap into, you know, the person you can be. I know a lot of people have a love-hate relationship with Eravan. Me, I just have a love relationship with him because like I get him. Like I wrote him. I know him. I know what he's thinking. So yeah.
I think as well, going outside into the jungle and kind of struggling with his magic, he's maybe realizing that it's not, life's not just completely easy and everything's not coming easy to him. Like, it's an actual struggle to kind of get to the, like, well, the point when it all goes wrong.
Yeah. Both Ahilya and Eravan are such hyper competent people. Like, they're very, very good at their jobs. And, you know, they are at the pinnacle of whatever they can do, you know, in their own careers. And whether or not those careers are going the way they want to is a secondary question, but they're very good at what they do. They're very smart. They're very, you know, resourceful. And in Eravan's case, many times things come easy to him because he is genuinely just that good at his job. Like, he's very good at what he does, and they do come easy to him. He climbed the ladder to success quite quickly. But it doesn't make him, I don't think it makes him dismissive of how hard it can be, but I think it makes him callous, you know, that other people might not have the same kind of experience that he has. So when he does go into the jungle and he sees like, wow, I'm struggling too, like something terrible is happening, and I'm like, this is even beyond my powers, I think that's when it hits him. One, his own fallibility kind of hits him, right? He's like, wow, I can't do everything. And two, like something else is going on here. So that was a very interesting scene for me to write.
I should have asked you about how you pronounce his name. Om.
Just ignore the A part of the name. Om is fine.
Okay. He dies in the Earth Rage, which is quite sad because he seems like a sweet boy.
Yeah.
And both of them want to kind of take responsibility for what's happened. Is there a big significance? And I was wondering if this was tied back to Hindu philosophy, but is there a big significance in the fact that his fathers don't get his body after he dies to kind of give him proper funeral treatments?
I think this, if there is a significance, it was done very subtly. But now when I think about it, yeah, I think that definitely feeds into Hindu philosophy. So in Hinduism, you don't bury your body, you cremate it. And then it goes, the ashes go back, you know, essentially the philosophy being that the body goes back to earth where it came from, and disintegrates, etc. And then the soul moves into the cosmic karmic cycle of birth and rebirth, right? So we never, not only do Om's fathers not get their body, we don't actually even see Om, like he just kind of disappears into the earth, right? He gets dropped and like he dies, right? Nothing survives. And I've had people question me, you know, for closure, to say, please tell me he's coming back. Is he coming back? Is he alive? I'm like, he's not alive. He's dead. Like he just fell into like a massive storm. Like there is no way he's alive. And that actually feeds into a lot of fantasy tropes about, you know, characters coming back when you think they're dead. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm not servicing a trope here. This is, it's just how it is. It is very sad what happens to him, because he is, at the end of the day, just an innocent boy who kind of, you know, for a harmless infatuation went out, and then this horrible tragedy kind of happened. His body not returning is, I think, indicative of the Hindu philosophy piece of bodies being an ephemeral sheet, really. You know, we move, a soul moves from one body into another, and when you're born and reborn and that kind of thing. But the impact that his death has on Ahilya and Iravan, I think that is a very real thing, because philosophy aside, death is death, and it has an impact on the people who are left behind. And in this case, it was Ahilya and Iravan, who both of them were very deeply marked by Om's death in their own ways, taking responsibility, you know, them being just being a turning point in both their lives and their marriage and all of that. It's also, I think, for me, it was also like a way to kind of show how, you know, here are these two adults who are talking about having kids, etc. And this one time they had, who is essentially a kid, you know, in their care, this horrible thing happened. And are they really prepared to be parents? You know, is there any room in their marriage for another life? And have they made that kind of room if these are the choices that they're making, if this is how they are thinking, and, you know, if this is a situation that they've been put into? So there's a little bit of that in there as well.
This sounds like we're totally bashing Ahilya. No. Team Iravan. If I was Iravan, I'd have reservation about telling her things, to be honest. You know, at one point she accuses him of avoiding the truth, but we then find out later that he wasn't allowed to tell her certain things because they hadn't had a child, and she's still not happy. And he risks poisoning himself later, you know, he risks poisoning himself to tell her things later on.
He does. Yeah. And I feel like at this stage, it's easy to forget just the many, many years of lies by omission and the chances that Ahilya gave Iravan for all of the many things. It's easy to forget in the truth that ultimately Iravan tells her. Was he not allowed to tell her things? Yeah. Was he, you know, did they need to have a child in order for that to happen? Yeah. Did he abandon her for 7 months on what was essentially a ridiculous, like, reason? He did. He abandoned her for 7 months. So yes, he is not allowed to tell Ahilya certain things about his job, but he also doesn't go out of his way to build that trust. He just assumes that the trust is going to be given to him. And Ahilya is not the kind of woman who is going to do that. Like, she's like, I will give you trust. And, you know, after a point, you don't even have to earn it. I married you. But then what Iravan proceeds to do after that is, with every action, he starts to erode whatever trust there is. Up until the point in the book, and this happens in the first few chapters, that we learn he's done this, he just abandons her for no reason for 7 months, and they have a fight, he walks away, he doesn't come back, she has no way to get to him because of the many permissions that she doesn't have, she contacts him and says, you know, they should talk and they should reconcile, he ignores her, and then he just takes off for 7 months. So yeah, I think when you're reading that part of the book, it does appear like that. And I think that is the interesting relationship that they have with each other, is, you know, you kind of see one person's point of view and you're like, yeah, I think they're right. And then you see the other person's point of view and you're like, well, I think they're right. And in this case, it is simple, I think, and easy to forget just how much Ahilya endured and how she still stuck by Iravan. You know, she knows that being married is an important part of his job. And though she herself is so very unhappy, she still stays in the marriage for him. You know, he has not given her any reason to stay in the marriage, you know, but except for who he used to be once upon a time. And she still has faith in that person, which is why she hasn't left him, at least, you know, as the story kind of starts. But you also look back and you see just how much she had to swallow, you know, how much of her own pride she had to swallow, how many lies she had to save for him, you know, how many times she had to save face because he put her in a difficult position, including at a point where he hijacked her mission, you know, and he's just like, either you go with me or you don't go at all. By virtue of who he is, I think he does keep doing things the wrong way, even though he might be doing it for a right reason, just because it's the most efficient way to him. I think at the heart of it, Iravan is, and I think this comes up in the book as well, he's a very blunt man. And so if, you know, he'll try 2-3 methods, but if it doesn't work, he'll be like, all right, I'm just going to do whatever the fuck I want and everybody else can deal with it. And most often that everybody else is Ahilya, and it's her feelings and her pride and just all of the things that she cares about. Those are all collateral damage. So yeah, there's a little like, yes, you know, did he have a point? Could he not tell her? Sure. Yeah. But were there other better ways to do this? Yeah, there were. Like, dude, you had many chances. You could have built that trust. You could have made her want to have a baby just, you know, if you treated her well, if your marriage was good. Like, there were other architects in that situation too, you know, the first one, right? Like, people have been here before.
Yeah, the audacity of him with that mission when he just turns up. That was bad. I know I liked him, but I liked him more, I think, after the first maybe 100-150 pages, when you've moved on from the mission and him ignoring her for 7 months, which would drive me absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
Then I started to like him. But at first, he did sort of frustrate me. I'd have been tempted to, if I was her, to be like, you know what, I'm not going to go on the mission, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like that would have been, for a lot of us, that would have been the way that we would do. But this is the one thing she cares about, and he threatened it. And then she was like, is it worth it? Like, this is my once in a lifetime kind of chance, and I'm not going to let him ruin it. Right. So she really took that perspective. But I actually remember when I wrote that scene the first time, and then my husband read it, and he just hated Iravan. Like, he was like, oh my God, this guy is an absolute prick. Like, oh, he could not hate Iravan more. Like, And I think that for my husband, that actually has persisted over, you know, over the course of the book as well, just because that's the first time Iravan really does something so terrible. And my husband has not gotten past that one experience. He's just like, no. And it's funny because I always think that, you know, between the two characters, if I were to pick, I think that I am a lot like Iravan, but not in the terms of his brutalities and things like that. My husband says that if at all I'm like any of the characters, he doesn't think I'm like either, but if he had to pick, he would say I'm more like Ahilya because she's so steadfast and loyal and, you know, all of those nice, wonderful things. But in my head, like, I feel closer to Iravan. He was a lot easier character to write somehow, because you see him very bluntly for who he is and who he's trying to be. And you see all the darkness within him, and you see all the hopes and, you know, all the good intentions and everything that he has. And I think that relationship, if we're lucky, we're able to see all of that about ourselves too. So from that perspective, like, I always kind of related a little bit more to Iravan. But then I have readers coming back to me saying that they are relating so hard to Ahilya. You know, they're like, she is amazing. Like, she, how is she enduring this like horrible man? Like, leave his ass like this minute, girl. So I'm like, oh, I don't know what to say. Like, you know, when I always feel compelled that when somebody's trash talking Ahilya, then I should stand up for her. And if somebody's trash talking Iravan, then I should stand up for him. Because in my mind, they're both right and they're both wrong, you know? So you kind of, when people take sides, and it's really fun, but it's also like, oh man, but also the other side.
One thing that I'm really fascinated by is your world building process with the plants. And one that really, really interested me was the Veristem.
Yep.
And I mean, Charlotte were messaging about it, and it reminded me of a potion called Veritaserum in a book by She Who Must Not Be Named, mm-hmm. Which I loved as a child, which I loved when I was younger, but yeah. And Charlotte taught me that Veritas is Latin for truth, which I didn't know and found really interesting. So what was kind of your world building like with the plants? Did you do research? Are any of them real? Kind of how did all that happen? Because it's such a big part of the world and I loved it.
Yeah, so as you said, like veritas being Latin is exactly where veritum kind of came from. It, like, I think another one of the things that I wanted to do is there's a lot of in-world terminology within the book, and some of it is based off of Sanskrit terms and, you know, Hindu philosophy terms, etc. But there are some as well which are based very much just maybe Latin terms, just like veritum, etc., you know, so more rooted in English as we kind of know it right now. And that was a conscious choice, a very conscious decision to have like both of those worlds in there at the same time. And I've kind of thought, I've kind of said this before as well, just how the world of the surviving sky is very much Southeast Asian. It is Hindu philosophy based, but it is also a secondary world fantasy, you know, for fantasy lovers, regardless of this quote unquote diversity element that they're looking for. You know, it is just a good, fun science fiction and fantasy, science fantasy book. Does it have great representation? Yeah, I think so. You know, does it have philosophies that have not been explored? Yeah, for sure. Is it, with or without that, is it still like a really fun read and a good book to read? Yeah, it is. You know, I think a lot of times authors of color and or even like not necessarily authors of color, but just authors belonging to different backgrounds can be pigeonholed very much into writing one or other kind of work, to say, you know, you've written Chinese mythology, this is all you can write for the rest of your life. You know, you've written like Hindu philosophy, this is all you can write for the rest of your life, etc. Like, I think publishing can pigeonhole you quite easily. And for me, this was consciously a choice to not want to be pigeonholed. Like, I want to write the stories that I like, you know, and I like all kinds of things. So just because I belong to a certain community, etc., doesn't mean that that is necessarily the only thing I want to write about.
I love how you just say, is this a good story? Yes. It's like, no doubt in your mind that this is good. And I respect that so much.
Thank you.
Well, we all need to be like that.
No, thank you. But in terms of a lot of other plants, etc., I mean, I spent a lot of time building the world and naming the characters and all of that. But I will say that the plant names kind of grew organically. I kind of had this image in my head, and, you know, that's kind of where they bubbled from. So spiral weed is another example. Like, it is, you know, it's a plant that reacts to trajection and reacts quite badly sometimes. And in my head, I just had this image of this plant doing like really strange things and spiraling out of control. But also it was a contraband. So it's not a plant that has any real use, and it's not allowed in the city. So it was a weed, just like, you know, you don't allow it to grow. So that's really where spiral weed came from. And very stem, I already kind of spoke about. Heel branch is another one. Again, it was very much a visual in my head. Like, it was a plant that would heal, but it grew almost like a branch. So it was very much like, it was a little thicker. It was, you know, more woody. It had like a very specific kind of scent, which you could tell it from. And yeah, so if those parts of it, I think, came just very organically. I don't think those changed at all from like the placeholder names that I had initially. Very few things change in terms of their placeholder names, I will say. Like, that deciding the naming convention is one of the first few things I do, because unless I have the shape of that in my head correctly, I can't imbue it with a personality. So even with Ahilya and Aravan, like, I knew what their names were going to be right from the get-go. I can't just put placeholder names. Like, the name and the shape of the name really kind of occupy a space in my mind and, you know, become the personality of the characters and the world.
One theory that I found really interesting for the Earth Rages was the idea that it's all of the different consciousnesses of people kind of in conflict with each other, and that the lulls can happen when this isn't the case. And you spoke a little bit earlier about the idea of consciousness being taken from Hindu philosophy.
So yeah, so the way the lulls work, and so the way the Earth Rages work, is that when consciousnesses in general in the world, whether it's plant or human or yaksha or whatever, when those are in high conflict, that's when Earth Rages occur. And when those are in low conflict, that's when lulls occur. Lulls are in the world kind of looked upon as this almost a period of peace, because the planet has kind of come to a rest, at least, you know, a little bit, that the storms have kind of abated. It's interesting to kind of think about it from a Hindu philosophical perspective, because that sense of peace that Hindu philosophy often talks about is in our own personal consciousnesses. Like, you know, you close your eyes, you're meditating or whatever, and you have 100,000 thoughts that flood your brain. You know, you I don't know about you, but if I kind of sit down to meditate or practice yoga or whatever, you know, you're supposed to kind of focus maybe only on your breath or watch your thoughts and all of those things, but it is much, much harder to actually put into practice. So there is, even within your own consciousness, there's conflict. And peace, in whatever way it is recognized in Hinduism, is very much about that absence of, you know, that chaos. So I did want to kind of personify that a little bit within the book itself, and within the world. And that's really how it kind of came about to be. High conflict is when the world itself is chaotic, right? And low conflict of consciousness is when the world, such as it is in that space, is a little bit more peaceful.
We find out that Bhairavi has ecstasy or gone ecstatic. She and Iravan had previously made an agreement that they would kill the other as an act of mercy if this happened to either one of them. And we got the impression that this would affect whichever in a future life. If this idea of coming back in different ways, is that from Hindu philosophy, like the reincarnation?
Yeah, it very much is. That reincarnation is a very, you know, it's one of the cornerstones of Hindu philosophy. Is very much like, you know, you are on this planet or in this world right now in this form and this body and these memories and, you know, these experiences, etc. They will have an impact on your immortal soul, so to speak, which will then go on to, you know, be birthed again. So very much like moving from body to body. And again, like what you do in one life will impact what happens in the other life. So in Iravan and Bhairavi's case, this was even the violence of her death and the fact that either one of them does it. Like this is a violent action that is going to have an impact. And they know that from the beginning, because Iravan actually studies consciousness. They know that. And so this is the action that they choose to take, knowing that it can have some kind of a future impact on their own immortal soul in the future and the quality of the life that they might live again in a future life. In the book, I've tried to draw this like clarification, I want to say, between, yes, there's your soul is, and I don't use the word soul in the book, and I'm only using it now just because I'm being a little lazy. I don't, that's not necessarily the word I would really choose. In Hindu philosophy, that is a word they use, but as a term in English language, it has so many different meanings and weights, etc., which are not things that I personally might subscribe to or even think that Hindu philosophy does. But for lack of a better word, let's just go with soul. So there is this clarification that I'm trying to draw in the book between, yes, you have your immortal soul, which does get affected by certain things, but also moves into a new life and all of that, carrying some memories and some intentions of your previous life. But just because you have that doesn't absolve you from the choices that you make in this world and in this life. You can't just kind of wash your hands and say, oh, I'll just, you know, do whatever the fuck I want, because like it's not really affecting, you know, anything. And reality is not really, you know, real, and all of those many beautiful philosophical loopholes that one can climb out of. And some characters try to do that, but they're always grounded back into it. And the world at the end of the day is very earthy. It's very grounded, even if it is floating. Call that difference between what you do right now matters. Even if there is the possibility of a future life, your choices right now matter. So this was something I was very intentional about going in. Like, you don't just get out of jail free card. That's not how this works. And that is not how it works in Hindu philosophy either. It's not just a function of this world.
Well, bearing all that in mind, you might not want to answer this question, but do you think that you might have made the same kind of agreement that they make? Because what happens afterwards sounds horrible, where you're basically a kind of vegetable and you just lose yourself completely. And obviously that would have a horrible impact on your family too. So do you think you might have made the same kind of agreement as they did?
I don't know. Such a personal question. I don't know if I've thought about it, you know, in that kind of depth, really. I mean, I have, like, from a thought experiment perspective, but I know one thing, that is not a decision I would take without consulting people I love. It is not a decision I would take in isolation, because no matter what that end result looks like, whether or not it is, you know, me being in a different state of existence now versus not being around as well, it doesn't just impact me, it impacts the people around me too. And I think that was the decision that Ahilya disagreed with when it came to Ahilya and Iravan, is that you took this decision without even talking to me about it. Like, this has an impact on the people you leave behind. And like Bharavi took that decision while talking to her wife, right? Like, she actually did do that, but Iravan didn't. He had his reasons, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure, like, we can, but he still did it. And, you know, it was from his perspective, it was very much a selfish decision. And I don't think I would do that. Like, I would involve people in my life, just like you would for, you know, any big decision in your life. You talk to people who love you.
Could he have talked to her about it? Because she's not allowed to know what would have happened if they'd gone ecstatic, right, without having a kid. So could he have, was there a loophole maybe or a way around how he could have talked to her before making that decision?
Yeah, I think if things were good in their marriage, then he would have found a way. Like, this is Iravan we're talking about. He is very, very smart. Like, he will find things that, you know, he will figure a way out. Like, he's very good with language. He's very good with words. He's very, you know, he's a very talented architect. As an architect, it's his entire job to find hidden paths and hidden ways to get what he wants. So I think if things were good with them, he would have told her, despite them not having a kid. But then again, if things were good with them, they probably would have had a child already. Right? So it's a very, like, it's a hypothetical question. Could he have done it? I think he could have found a way. And I think if not that, then he would have pushed a little harder to change the rules so that he was allowed to tell her. You know, he was in a position of power. Like, he chose where to devote his energies. But had he chosen, he could have chosen to devote his energies to this, you know, because he was like, I think I should tell her. So I think it is an easy answer to say he wasn't allowed to, but, like, as we kind of find out in the book, like, Iravan doesn't very much care about what he's allowed to do or not. He just goes and does it anyway. So
at the beginning of the expedition, Iravan senses no consciousness in the Yakshas. And at the time, he's really confused. He, you know, he's like, well, they're not dead. Later on in the book, there's a discussion about whether or not they're actually of a higher consciousness than humans. Are we just inherently arrogant enough to assume that we're at the pinnacle of almost anything?
Oh, absolutely. Look at the world around us. Look at how we behave when we are confronted with any other kind of existence except our own. And you can use our both in terms of within the human species, the groups that we ourselves belong to. It's very us versus them, you know. Oh, we know better than that group. We know even better than that group about what they want, which is what the architects, you know, often do. Like, they're like, we'll take decisions for the non-architects and their survival. We know what they want. You know, like, have you talked to them? And that might be a good beginning. So they might be able to consult on that. But as a human species as well, like, I mean, we don't even really need to look far. Look at what we've done to our world. There are themes of climate change within The Surviving Sky and the Rages trilogy, and that's not incidental. That was, again, it wasn't very deliberately put, but it was one of those things that kind of organically developed, and I wanted to keep it, so I developed it further. But that arrogance of the human species, that we are at the top of the food chain, we have the highest consciousness, we are the smartest in the world, in the universe, you know, everything should bow down to us. But take a look at a couple of pictures from NASA and you're like, wow, we are really, really tiny, right? Like, we are a dot in a dot in a dot, like, nothing matters. Like, our existence, et cetera, is so limited. That arrogance is also very interesting coming from a person like Iravan, who is, you know, who acknowledges just how arrogant he is. You know, he says, you've told me I'm an arrogant man. He owns it, you know, he doesn't apologize for it, which is fine. Like, I can respect that as, you know, theoretically I can respect that, but it's interesting coming from him as well, because he is actually really good at his job. He knows what he's doing, and he doesn't sense that. And eventually that realization that his consciousness or that of his kind is not at the highest level of consciousness is very interesting for him, because he doesn't come to it thinking, oh no, I've been knocked off my high pedestal. He comes to it as an academic thinking, wow, that's really interesting. How can I understand it? And that's one of those redeeming features about Iravan. I think in our world right now, we are missing that humility, that despite Iravan being an arrogant man, he is still in many ways also a humble man. I don't personally think that those are two opposites. I don't think you can be either humble or arrogant. I think it's very, very normal, human, totally acceptable, and, you know, normal just to be both. And I think Iravan personifies that really well. He's both humble and arrogant, you know. And I think in this case, we as a human species generally right now are missing that humility for our world. We're missing that sense of curiosity. But say what you will about the man, he's infinitely curious. Like, he sees a problem and he's like, oh, this is cool. Like, I want to understand it. Like, that's what he does with the resonance too. It's, if he sees something he doesn't understand, he immediately wants to, he's a scientist, right? Like, he wants to be like, what is this?
In a job interview that I had for the job I'm at now, I said, like, I'm really confident that I'm really good at my job. But because I'm so confident, I'm okay with asking for help if I don't know something. And so I think that's what you're saying about having the sort of the arrogance and the humility. And it can be such a good combination,
yep,
to have the two things together.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I think it's a very seductive combination. And in Iravan's case, it definitely is, because it, you know, it does show the confidence that he has in himself and his own work ethic and just his own competence. But it also shows the vulnerability, which, you know, often is hidden in Iravan, but, you know, it just comes out in flashes, his vulnerability, which in many ways, like, takes the readers for a trip. And, you know, even for me, when I'm rereading the book, like, that tends to take my breath away. I'm like, oh, where did that vulnerability come from? You
know, well, he is an absolute powerhouse of a man.
Yeah,
so awesome. The final question we have before we say goodbye, and this is something that I've been wondering sort of like through most of the book, there are different yakshas that are different, like, animal forms of yakshas. And I know that there's a tiger, there's a falcon, there's an elephant. So I was wondering about the significance of the animals that you chose, if there was one.
So the significance is, like, well, I just picked the coolest animals I thought, you know, were that was one part of it. But yakshas are also, in Hindu mythology, they're forest spirits. And often they would be represented as animals, but sometimes they were just forest spirits, like, and just like nymphs, etc., would be, you know, so yakshas were a part of that. Who were kind of mischievous, but also like guardians of the forest and that kind of thing. So there was an element of that, which I kind of wanted to introduce into the book very obliquely, because again, like, if you don't know it, if one doesn't know about these things, then it's really not going to strike you. But again, if it doesn't strike you, it doesn't matter, because they don't really, you don't need to know any of that to enjoy the book. It's just kind of like a little Easter egg I left for myself or people who might pick up on that. So the animals I picked just because they were cool, and oftentimes these animals also make an appearance in Hindu philosophy. So you have a lot of stories about tigers, you know, they form the vehicle for a few goddesses. You have stories about elephants, of course, highly revered in Indian culture, and falcons as well. You know, falcons were creatures of the heaven. Yeah, just some cool animals that I thought would serve the story best and also just be entertaining for me, really.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to us today. We really enjoyed the book and how you did so many different things within it. And so we're really looking forward to what comes next. So can you give us any teasers for book two?
Yeah. Oh, book two. Book two is, so I wrote book two a while ago, and it's with my editors right now. I'm actually midway through book three. So very close to finishing the trilogy, and feels like bizarre to say that given the first book is not quite out yet. But book two, so I love book two so far. I think of the three, I haven't finished the third one yet, but book two is definitely one of my favorite ones, the favorite one of the trilogy. Things get a lot more complicated for our protagonists. So after book one, they've learned some very important lessons about themselves and their world, and they don't go back and make those mistakes anymore, but they do go back and make new mistakes, and they find that while they have evolved, you know, the world might not have. And here they are faced with a very critical reason to change the world and have it evolve to a point where they think it needs to, but they're still really struggling with their own issues, which are newer issues. Iravan has redeemed himself many times over by the end of book one. Ahilya has moved into a position where she always dreamed of being. At the start of book two, she has more power than she did at book one. And the tables are kind of turned, because in book one, Iravan had all the power and Ahilya had none. But in book two, you kind of see it the other way around, where Iravan has none of the power and Ahilya has loads. So it's just a very interesting place to be, even for their own marriage.
we also know how publishing works. So do you have any other projects that you can talk about at the moment, or are you solely focused on finishing the trilogy?
I do have other projects. Some of them are very exciting. They're in a different genre, but I'm not sure if I can talk about them yet.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. We know how publishing works, so we figured that's what you would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could, because I'm so excited about them all, but all in due course. I'm trying to focus on these projects while I, you know, still can.
It's nice to know that we've got more exciting stuff to look forward to in the future.
Thank you. That's very kind.
And where can people go to find you and support you online?
So I am available on my website, which is like a standard foundational, you know, piece of internet that I can call my own. It's www.kritikahrao.com. But I'm also available on Instagram and Twitter occasionally. You know, I might miss messages there because Twitter is Twitter now. but my handle is also Kritika H. Rao. You can always leave me a note on my website. And if I can, I'm happy to respond.
We'll put all of that in our episode description so that people can easily find you and follow you and stay up to date with details for release 4, 2, 3 and future projects.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging out with us today. And again, special thanks to Kritika. Follow us on Instagram at Demythifying the Podcast for more episodes. And if you're liking what we're doing, please rate, subscribe and share. It really helps us out. Check out our website at www.demythpod.co.uk. I've been Charlotte, she's been Lauren, and today we've been turning pages with Kritika H. Rao.